Part 1. Leaker present, leaker past. The mice will win in the end. But in the meantime, the cats will be well fed. Bruce Schneier. Chapter 1. The Whistleblowers. When Dr. Daniel Ellsberg decided to violate 13 years' worth of security clearances, embark on the largest public breach of top-secret documents in the 20th century, and likely spend the rest of his life in prison, he faced a problem. How to duplicate 7,000 pieces of paper many times over using 1969 technology? RAND, the California military think tank where Ellsberg held a position two steps removed from the President of the United States, didn't have a Xerox machine. The technology was 20 years old, but still not widely used. And it presented some obvious security issues for an agency dealing with ultra-classified materials. So Ellsberg, a thin 38-year-old man with wiry dark hair and features that resembled a more Semitic Paul Newman, needed help. He contacted Tony Russo, a mildly subversive Virginian coworker, and Russo soon became the only other analyst at RAND who knew about and sympathized with Ellsberg's leaking plans. Russo found one of the newfangled photocopiers in the advertising agency of a friend who shared their anti-war agenda. Over the next year, Ellsberg would spend countless nights hauling RAND's papers out of the building in an inconspicuous briefcase, then standing in front of that primitive copier in a dark office, reproducing a secret history of America's involvement in Vietnam, the Pentagon Papers. It was tedious work. At first, Ellsberg tried to copy two pages at a time from one of the 47 bound volumes. But he found that the words near the spine were faded and distorted. So he resorted to disassembling the binder and photocopying the pages one by one. "I tried to program my motions," he wrote in his memoir, Secrets. One hand picked up a page, the other fitted on the glass top down, push the button, wait. Lift, move the original to the right while picking another page from the pile. This is all very familiar now, but it was a new technology then. It took a little extra time to put the top down and up, and I didn't know why it had to be done. Did it have to do with the copying quality, or was the light bad for the eyes? Was it dangerously bright? How did it work anyway? Was that particular green color some kind of radiation? There were complications. Ellsberg intended to give portions of the papers to several senators, and if necessary, the news media too. To make multiple copies, he would have to hand the papers over to a professional copying office, where they'd be subjected to the curious eyes of who knew how many clerks. Inconveniently, the papers were marked with glaring top secret stamps across their tops and bottoms, with more classified signifiers peppered throughout the margins of the monstrous classified tomes. So at first, Ellsberg cut off the heads and feet of the pages with scissors, later upgrading to a paper cutter. Then Russo suggested he tape strips of cardboard over the top and bottom of the photocopier's glass face, what Ellsberg would later refer to as declassifiers. Even then, some words were cut off by the declassifiers, and small, randomly interspersed, top-secret markings lingered on the edges of the pages. Ellsberg had to comb through the encyclopedia-sized pile to excise them. When he thought he was ready to hand the first briefcase-sized fraction of the stack over to a New York copy shop months into his project, he riffled through the papers one last time and was startled to immediately find another page with an obvious, unsheared, top-secret marking. He left the copy shop and retreated to a lunch counter where he surreptitiously pruned more top-secret remnants out of the papers while attempting to nonchalantly consume a sweet roll and a cup of coffee over the course of several hours. The process was punctuated by Ellsberg's periodic visits by the local police. Russo's friend in advertising wasn't particularly skilled at manipulating her office's security system, and the result was multiple silent alarms, an average of 3 a week, that brought in bored policemen to check on the distinguished-looking man who always seemed to be photocopying late at night. Ellsberg would casually cover the classified documents on the desk beside the copy machine, greet the policeman politely, and carry on his work as soon as they left. Ellsberg recruited Russo to help with the endless task, along with Russo's advertising friend, Ellsberg's second wife, Patricia, even his 2 13- and 10-year-old children from his first marriage. Why did Ellsberg involve his children? He writes that he expected to spend the next decades talking to them only through a pane of glass in a federal prison, and he wanted them to at least understand exactly what he had done and why. Even with his ragtag team's help, it took the Harvard and Cambridge-educated analyst more than a year of on-and-off grunt work to create a full set of the papers and duplicate them at commercial copy centers, eventually creating an 8-foot-tall stack of breached classified documents. At 10 cents a page in those shops, the process also required Ellsberg to spend several thousand dollars, the equivalent of more than $20,000 today, accounting for inflation. Once, when he sent a batch of papers off to Senator William Fulbright, Fulbright's aide politely offered to reimburse him. But when Ellsberg named the price, $345, including postage, the aide hastily rescinded the offer. Fulbright, who had told Ellsberg he would launch congressional hearings based on the documents, would later rescind that offer, too. The data leaks that would earn Army Private First Class Bradley Manning the alleged title of the world's most prolific whistleblower weren't merely orders of magnitude larger than Ellsberg's Pentagon Papers. Compared to photocopying 7,000 pages several times over, Manning's leaks were also phenomenally easier. The difference between spending months harvesting a season of crops and playing a few hours of Farmville on Facebook. In the midst of his work as a low-level intelligence analyst in Iraq, Manning slipped a rewritable CD marked with Lady Gaga into the tray of his work machine, a PC connected only to the military's high-security secret Internet Protocol Router Network, or SIPRNet. The SIPRNet was air-gapped. It wasn't connected to the Internet through any plug or wireless signal. But Manning could simply copy the CD's music to the computer, delete it from the rewritable disk, burn whatever top-secret data he wanted to the piece of plastic, and walk away with it minutes later. I listened and lip-synced to Lady Gaga's Telephone while exfiltrating possibly the largest data spillage in American history, Manning would write a few months later. Pretty simple and unglamorous. The data caches that Manning replicated, allegedly, included 91,000 files from the war in Afghanistan, 392,000 from the Iraq War, 779 files of inmates in the Pentagon's Guantanamo prison, and 250,000 memoranda from the U.S. State Department, which also shared its data with troops via SIPRNet. If the Ellsberg of 1969 could have seen the size of those leaks and the ease with which Manning extracted them, he might have cried at the unfairness of technological progress. One of Manning's Lady Gaga CDs offered enough capacity to have stored the Pentagon Papers about 50 times over, and the laserhead that wrote to those disks could have accomplished in a minute or two what required a year of off-and-on work for Ellsberg and his photocopier. To turn that comparison around, how long would it have taken Ellsberg to copy a leak the size of Manning's using only his 1969 technology? On a modern copier, I found I could only achieve a pace of around 8 pages a minute. Assume that Ellsberg was able to photocopy for 8 uninterrupted hours out of every 24, say, from 9 at night to 5 in the morning to avoid suspicion and keep his demanding job at Rand. At that rate, and even with a 2011 photocopier magically transported to 1969, it would have taken Ellsberg 6 months of straight work to reproduce just one copy of the 261 million words included in the State Department cables, not even considering the Afghan or Iraqi files that Manning effortlessly transported onto his Lady Gaga CD. In fact, Ellsberg never worked steadily at that 8 pages a minute pace. If he had, he would have finished copying the Pentagon Papers in a week or less. But at the more realistic pace that Ellsberg set, factoring in the need for sleep, fear of being caught, his much slower copier, distractions, a high-level military job that often required late nights and travel, breaks to maintain his sanity, the need to make secondary copies, and the niggling task of manually scissoring out any evidence of the file's classification before turning them over to a professional copying service, he didn't finish his photocopier work for close to 3 months of solid work interspersed over a year. Adding in the textual data that filled the smaller but still massive files from two data-flooded wars and Ellsberg's need to make multiple copies, and it's possible to roughly extrapolate how long a Manning-sized leak would have realistically taken at Ellsberg's rate. About 18 years. Suffice it to say that by then, his revelations would have belonged in a history book rather than the New York Times. And therein lies the clearest of so many differences between the act of leaking in the 20th century and the 21st. Daniel Ellsberg was born into an upper-middle-class Chicago family in 1931, in the depths of the Great Depression. Though his parents were Russian-born Jews, they had converted and raised Ellsberg as a strict Christian Scientist. Ellsberg's father was trained as an engineer, but like many men in that decade, spent years without work. Although Ellsberg would later come to admire his father, the rosy-cheeked boy with a dark, wiry coif first found a different hero, his father's brother, Ned Ellsberg, the Navy admiral and writer. Admiral Ellsberg had risen to fame as a member of the Navy's submarine salvage team, invented an underwater torch for cutting through the steel of sunken ships' hulls, and wrote a dozen fiction and non-fiction books with titles like Men Under the Sea, Ocean Gold, and I Have Just Begun to Fight. The young Ellsberg devoured the books and looked up to their author. Ellsberg's father found work first in Springfield, Illinois, and later in Detroit in 1937. Then the family moved to the middle-class Highland Park suburb. Ellsberg, an intensely intelligent child with few friends, won a scholarship to attend the prestigious Cranbrook Private School, just as World War II began to rage in Europe. Despite his reverence for his military uncle, Ellsberg's early memories of war itself were of a vague and evil specter. One of his elementary school teachers passed around a model of a magnesium bomb, of the kind capable of penetrating buildings and remaining alight continuously, no matter how much water was poured on it. A particle, we were told, would burn through flesh to the bone, and wouldn't stop burning even then, he wrote. It was hard for me to understand people who were willing to burn children like that. It still is. Ellsberg was a top student in his classes. But his mother wanted her son to be the next Vladimir Horowitz or Arthur Rubinstein. And it was to the piano that she committed nearly all his time. He was expected to practice for 6 to 7 hours a day. Reading was considered a vice and a distraction, and Ellsberg remembers his mother quietly hiding his books to keep him at the keyboard. As obediently as Ellsberg followed his mother's ambitions, he was less willing to blindly accept the religion that his parents lived by. At Sunday school, he peppered his teacher with tough theological questions. Later, in his teens, he read and deeply absorbed an exposé of plagiarism in the works of Mary Baker Eddy, Christian Science's founder, that shook the faith his parents had tried to instill in him. One summer day in 1946, much of the influence that Ellsberg's family held over his life suddenly, violently vanished. On a road trip to a party in Denver, Ellsberg's father fell asleep at the wheel of the family sedan. He awoke just seconds before the car plowed into the concrete structure of an overpass, demolishing the right side of the vehicle. Ellsberg's mother was killed instantly. Though the details were initially kept from him, Ellsberg later learned she was beheaded. His father received facial injuries but survived. Ellsberg awoke 36 hours later. His sister never did. When Ellsberg gained consciousness, his father had gone back to Michigan, leaving him in a Denver hospital with his mother's family. For months after the accident, the elder Ellsberg felt too guilty to face his son. Daniel, for his part, was overcome with a strange emotional numbness. He once said that his first thought after his mother's death was simply, "I guess I don't have to play the piano anymore." When Ellsberg did return to Michigan, he was suddenly freed from piano practice and instead began to hungrily consume books. He dramatically accelerated his progress as a student and 2 years later won a scholarship from the Pepsi-Cola Corporation to attend Harvard. One evening early in his time at the university, while sitting on a bench with a beer and a Hemingway novel, he had an epiphany. "It felt so strange. I couldn't figure out what it was," he told a biographer. "Then I realized I felt free for the first time in my life." Ellsberg married his college girlfriend, Carol Cummings, graduated from Harvard, and won a Woodrow Wilson Fellowship to spend a year studying at Cambridge University. When he returned, he was more than ready to join the war in Korea, a conflict he saw through the simple Cold War lens of a communist aggressor pushing into a would-be democratic state. He enlisted in the Marines, prepared to fight alongside his brothers at the 49th parallel. But instead, he spent the next 2 years in officers' training in Quantico, Virginia, long enough that when he emerged, the war was over. He had graduated again at the top of his class of 1,000 soldiers. Just months into that military career, Ellsberg was handed his first top-secret security clearances. Many years and many layers of privileged knowledge later, Ellsberg would have a conversation about that rite of passage with Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, one that he documented in his memoir. Kissinger was about to receive his own high-level clearances, and Ellsberg wanted to prepare him for the heady effects of that rarefied information. So he described for Kissinger the experience of entering a world of secrets. At first, Ellsberg said, he'd felt exhilarated at the enormous bounty of incredible facts that flooded into his intelligence. But that initial feeling soon gave way, and instead he felt like a fool for having worked for so long without those secrets, under such a veil of illusions and ignorance. A couple weeks later, he began to see everyone else as fools, watching them labor under that same malformed knowledge he had suffered from for years. It would take years more, Ellsberg recounted, before he finally began to see the limits of his top-secret information, the ways that it blinded him and led him astray with the sense of omniscience it offered. In the intervening time, he says, those secrets often prevented him and other secret keepers from learning anything from anyone who didn't have their clearances. "Knowing secrets," Ellsberg told Kissinger, "requires a person to lie to and distrust everyone who advises him." I ended by saying that I'd long thought of this kind of secret information as something like the potion Circe gave to the wanderers and shipwrecked men who happened on her island, which turned them into swine, Ellsberg wrote of his warning to Kissinger. They became incapable of human speech and couldn't help one another to find their way home. If Ellsberg's path to becoming the most prolific leaker of his age began with a steep upward trajectory fueled by Ivy League ambition, Bradley Manning set out from far more common circumstances: destitute, middle American aimlessness. Manning grew up in Crescent, Oklahoma, a tiny conservative town that had one stop sign and 15 churches, more pews than people, as Manning would later write. He was a bright child who could read at 3, built his first website at 10, and won the top prize at his school science fair 3 times. He also had a rebellious streak that led him to ask hard questions of religious neighbors, argue with Sunday school teachers, and even remain silent during the Pledge of Allegiance in school to avoid its "under God" doctrine. But those from his hometown described him to the local magazine, This Land, as a quiet, good-natured boy, small for his age, who studied hard, played saxophone in the school band, loved video games like the military simulation Command and Conquer, and talked sometimes of joining the army one day. Manning's father, Brian, had a more mixed reputation in the neighborhood where Manning grew up. A gruff former Navy computer analyst who worked as an IT manager for Hertz Car Rentals, he was also a strict and unforgiving father. One neighbor has described him as demeaning, another as simply a dick. Brian Manning would leave on business, sometimes for months at a time. His wife, a woman named Susan Fox, whom Manning had met while stationed in the United Kingdom in the late 70s, couldn't drive, and they lived 4 miles from town. So the older Manning would stock up the house with food and supplies and leave them largely isolated. Fox filled the void of her loneliness with alcohol, starting with vodka in her morning tea. When Manning was 13, his father announced one evening that he was separating from Manning's mother. Fox would bring Manning back to her hometown, the Welsh village of Haverford West, not much larger than Crescent. If growing up as the only American in a small British community hadn't been alienating enough, Manning now faced another new emotional challenge. Just before leaving Oklahoma, he had announced to friends that he was gay. Manning never publicized his homosexuality in Wales, but he was treated as an outsider nonetheless, teased for his accent, his effeminate mannerisms, his small size. Even as an adult, Manning would only measure 5'2" and 105 pounds. Manning's inability to fit in wasn't helped by a fierce sense of American patriotism that he inherited from his father. One friend from Crescent described him as basically really into America, particularly American sense of political and economic liberty, not often an outlook shared by the residents of parochial ends of the United Kingdom. Alienated from most of his peers, Manning turned to the outlet of so many other young men, computers and the Internet. He spent his lunch periods in the school's computer lab, coding a website that functioned like a primitive version of Facebook, allowing users to create communities and find local news. In the process, he learned about the basics of web servers and internet routing. When he graduated from high school, Manning's strong connection to the United States brought him back to Oklahoma to live with his father and now 2 stepbrothers in Oklahoma City. He put his computer skills to use at a software startup called Zodo. The tech firm was a more politically liberal setting than Manning had ever been exposed to, and co-workers remember him speaking out loudly against the deteriorating war in Iraq and criticizing President Bush. In his work, he was a competent coder, but his loneliness and angst sometimes hampered his productivity. One manager, Cord Campbell, has recalled Manning's thousand-mile stare and described him as quirky as hell. Manning developed a reputation as odd and unreliable. After a shouting match with his boss, he was fired. At the same time, the young man's relationship with his restrictive father and new family was fraying quickly. Manning would say years later that he was kicked out of his home because he was gay. But his father told a PBS Frontline reporter that he had always accepted his son's sexuality. And a 9/11 recording of a call from Manning's father's second wife describes Manning throwing objects and threatening her with a knife. "I have been telling him he needs to get a job, and he won't get a job," Manning's stepmother says frantically in the recording. "He said he thinks he should just be able to take money from us." Manning wasn't arrested, but he was escorted from the house by police. Days later, he left in his Toyota pickup truck and drove to Tulsa, homeless, directionless, and largely alone in the world. For the next months, Manning slept first in his truck and then later in the room of a friend from Crescent, Jordan Davis, hiding in the bedroom from Davis's father until he could find a bare-bones apartment in town. He flitted between menial jobs, working first in a Chuck E. Cheese-style entertainment center called Incredible Pizza as a waiter, later at a music and video game store. He drifted to Chicago and then to Maryland, working retail jobs at Guitar Center, Starbucks, and Abercrombie & Fitch, before finally moving in with his aunt near Rockville and enrolling in a local community college. Manning had learned the exhaustion of life without a degree. He writes that he was in desperation to get somewhere in life, but he couldn't afford a 4-year university. When he turned to his father for help, The elder Manning told him to take a well-worn path for resourceless and lost young men, the military. Despite Manning's patriotism and admiration of the armed forces years earlier, his opposition to the war in Iraq left him conflicted. Brian Manning, years later, would say of his son that he twisted his arm. He didn't want to join, Manning's father would tell the PBS show Frontline, but he needed structure in his life. He was aimless. I knew in my own life that joining the Navy was the only thing that gave me structure. The Army, as promised, swiftly imposed direction on Manning's career. After Manning enlisted in August 2007, he spent the next year in basic training, and then, when his superiors recognized his computer skills, specialized education in intelligence analysis. In October 2009, he shipped out to Iraq, a 22-year-old soldier, slight of frame and short on experience, inducted suddenly into wartime's wealth of secrets. Daniel Ellsberg read as much paperwork on the war in Vietnam as practically any Pentagon analyst. For one stretch in his first years at the Department of Defense, he requested that all new documents on the war be sent to his inbox, and he spent practically every waking moment digesting thousands of pages. But his real education on the war would come later, in the passenger seat of a Jeep traveling the roads of the countryside around Saigon with a rifle in his hand and a grenade in his lap. In 1962, Ellsberg had completed a doctorate at Harvard in economics, focusing on decision theory. His dissertation honed in on what would come to be known as the Ellsberg paradox, a strange glitch in the way that humans make choices. Show someone two opaque jars with 10 stones in each, one with 5 black stones and 5 white stones, and one with an unknown number of white and black stones. Then tell the test subject he'll be rewarded for picking a white stone. Experiments show that he'll tend to choose from the jar with a known equal number of black and white stones. But tell him a second later that he'll be rewarded for choosing a black stone, and he'll again choose the jar with known numbers of black and white stones. In both cases, human brains make the assumption that the uncertain jar is less likely to have a favorable ratio of stones, even when those assumptions contradict each other from one second to the next. When Ellsberg arrived at RAND as an analyst, the White House was already making its choice about which opaque jar it would rather gamble on: armed conflict in Vietnam, or the seemingly riskier idea of letting it fall to communism and increase the red blotch spreading across half the world map. Ellsberg spent years at the Pentagon-tied think tank RAND, and then as a military analyst in the Pentagon itself, inhaling war files and occasionally digging up documents to justify President Lyndon Johnson's moves to slowly widen the war in Vietnam. But he sensed that the paperwork he was sifting through wasn't the real war, and in 1965, he took a new job at the State Department. Soon he shipped out as a boots-on-the-ground analyst, eager to see the war for himself. He was entrusted with go-anywhere-see-everything status on the irregular banana-shaped landmass known as South Vietnam, and within weeks, he was in the field, accompanying troops on operations. Ellsberg found that he was considered a liability if he didn't carry a firearm or even if he hesitated to use it in combat situations. So despite his State Department's civilian observer status, he started carrying a Swedish K submachine gun alongside the soldiers he accompanied, even as he took notes and photographs as an analyst. The former soldier was soon adopted by John Vann, a seasoned retired lieutenant colonel in the Army who had also come to Vietnam as a civilian observer. Vann became Ellsberg's roving guide, mentor, and driver. That was no common privilege. Wheels were a risky way to see the country, and most officers didn't even dare to drive the roads through the swamps and jungles that Vann frequented, instead flying between bases by helicopter. At one point, the utility vehicle that Ellsberg and Vann traveled in momentarily broke down in the same spot where, 3 months later, Vann's assistant would be captured by Viet Cong and kept as a POW in a cramped bamboo cage for the next 7 years. But Van believed that driving was the only way for an officer to understand the real truths of the war, and he had learned that a single, nimble Jeep could evade Viet Cong mines. He taught Ellsberg the roadside clues that the VC firmly controlled certain areas, despite official reports to the contrary. Ellsberg learned to see freshly cut barbed wire fences, dug up roads, and destroyed buildings just a few feet away from outposts supposedly held by U.S.-friendly Vietnamese. As Ellsberg interviewed more advisors on the ground, he found more wishful thinking on the part of the U.S. forces. American bureaucrats were told, for instance, that pro-U.S. militias patrolled their territory at night. In reality, much of South Vietnam was handed over to the Viet Cong from sundown to sunrise. When Ellsberg stayed at a base in the town of Long An on Christmas Eve 1966, a very drunk South Vietnamese major began ranting about American arrogance and stupidity. Later, outside, he took several shots with a pistol at Ellsberg and his companions, missing them in the dark before other soldiers could restrain the enraged major. When Ellsberg quizzed a Vietnamese lieutenant about the incident later, the younger man reluctantly admitted that the resentment against American intervention wasn't unique. In fact, many of the other officers felt the same way. But Ellsberg's notion that Vietnam was an unwinnable war wasn't confirmed for him until New Year's Day 1967, the day he first came face-to-face with Viet Cong soldiers, or rather, face-to-back. As Ellsberg and three other soldiers walked ahead of a platoon of troops, they suddenly heard firing behind them. Three Vietnamese boys in black shorts had hidden in the grass just feet from where the four men's boots passed, popping up to fire their AK-47s at the troops behind Ellsberg's group. The four Americans didn't dare fire back toward their own men, and instead had to take cover from the hail of bullets sent back from the American platoon. The three Viet Cong boys disappeared into the jungle brush, only to hide and jump up 50 meters behind Ellsberg's forward group and pull the same trick again before vanishing. Three half-naked kids had shown a kind of fearlessness, cunning, and mastery of the terrain that an entire platoon couldn't counter. Later in the day, a pair of Viet Cong outfits performed an even more wily maneuver against Ellsberg's platoon, alternately firing on the Americans and then fading into the jungle, first from the left, then from the right, then from the left again. Each burst dragged the platoon toward their imagined attackers to counterattack, and they found themselves moving in a futile zigzag shape as they sought an efficient and ghostly enemy. "I was very, very impressed," wrote Ellsberg in Secrets. "The morning's work had sown in my guts a thought that had only been in my head before. These opponents were going to be very hard to beat. Or to put it another way, we were not going to defeat them." Over the next months, Ellsberg's feelings were reinforced with impossible missions, disappointing interviews with officers, and repeated glimpses of corruption among the military regime the United States supported. When he returned to RAND in the middle of 1967, he had decided he would work within the system to end this futile war. Ellsberg became a hard-nosed critic against the war effort within the think tank's walls, but his arguments merely convinced most colleagues that his experiences had destroyed his objectivity. Despite now working under Special Assistant for National Security Kissinger and others at that near-presidential level, he found that his pessimistic comments regarding Vietnam fell on deaf ears. Still, his time in Vietnam served a purpose beyond grim education. It made him one of the few RAND analysts chosen to work on a landmark study on the evolution of America's involvement in the country, a classified history that would trace the story of Vietnam's endless wars back to the French occupation and the Japanese invasion that preceded it. At the time, it was known as the McNamara Study, named for Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, who launched it before leaving government to become president of the World Bank. Today, that report is known as the Pentagon Papers. Ellsberg agreed to help write a portion of the study because he knew that the assignment would also provide him the access to read the entire report, a multi-volume comprehensive effort with the full analytic weight of RAND's brains behind it. And what he found, as he dug into historical documents and then got his hands on the first volumes of the papers in the following months, put his antipathy toward the war in a new light. The American quagmire in Vietnam wasn't an honest mistake, or even a mistake at all. It was the result of a decades-long policy, the tip of an ugly iceberg older and more trenchant than the Cold War itself. To summarize 7,000 pages, in a few words, the United States had controlled and incited the war in Vietnam, and it was a single war, not a series of wars against different regimes, for nearly 25 years. And its motives had always been those of geopolitical empire, never the democratic well-being of Vietnamese citizens. It started in the mid-40s, when the United States had financially and militarily supported France's control of Vietnam as a colony, and then backed its bloody reconquest of the country after French forces were temporarily interned and pushed aside by Japanese invaders. Despite pleas from Vietnamese President Ho Chi Minh to recognize Vietnamese independence, America's motivation was always, simply, to support its Western ally as a colonial power. Only after the rise of McCarthyism and the Maoist takeover of China did any question of communism versus democracy in Vietnam arise. And by then, it was too politically painful for any president to retreat from the country and allow the communist hemisphere of the globe to grow one sliver larger. Meanwhile, as every president from Truman to Kennedy to Johnson to Nixon sank deeper into the widening war, they had known that the conflict was inherently imperial from the start, and even seen State Department reports that showed that Ho Chi Minh had the majority support of the population. Vietnam had never been a true civil war. It was a war of conquest, initiated and perpetrated for more than two decades by the United States, fueled by presidential secrecy and lies. It was no catastrophic accident. As Ellsberg wrote, it was simply a crime. After his time on the ground, Ellsberg didn't need much convincing of the war's folly. But the Pentagon Papers put the stamp of historical confirmation on his determination to end it. And in 1969, that education as a leaker would be capped by a fateful trip he took to a Haverford College peace conference. For Ellsberg, simply attending a meeting full of peaceniks was a radical step. After the first day at the small Quaker school, he found himself on the sidewalk in nearby Philadelphia handing out anti-war pamphlets to passers-by, a tactic that at first felt awkward and ridiculous for a high-level insider who had vowed to end the war through his influence in Washington's power structure. The second day on Haverford's campus, a young man named Randy Keller stood up to speak to the crowd. Like Ellsberg, he had attended Harvard, then graduated from Stanford. Ellsberg was impressed with his poise and level-headed intellect, and remembers thinking that Keller was the best that we've got as a country. In a strong and steady tone, Keller explained that he had become the last remaining male member of the War Resisters League in San Francisco. All the others had been imprisoned for violating the draft. As Keller's voice cracked on stage, he told the audience how proud and happy he was that he would soon be joining his friends in prison. The crowd at first seemed stunned at the thought that the young man in front of them was about to be treated as a criminal. Then, thunderous applause broke out. But Ellsberg couldn't stand. He was emotionally devastated. The senior military analyst stumbled out of the auditorium and into an empty bathroom where he collapsed and sobbed for an hour. "It was as though an axe had split my head and my heart broke open," he writes. "But what had really happened was that my life had split in two." When Ellsberg recovered, he made a promise to himself. He would do whatever he could to end the war, even if it meant going to prison. Two essential traits of a leaker are an abundance of knowledge and a lack of power. And Bradley Manning both had access to far more information and wielded far less power than Ellsberg ever did. As the young soldier would later write, He was smart enough to know what's going on, but helpless to do anything. Manning's army career would quickly become as troubled as his pre-military life. By the middle of 2010, he had been demoted for hitting another soldier and shouting down a superior, assigned to hauling around boxes in the supply closet and working at events like a sparsely attended barbecue for a visiting team of cheerleaders. On one occasion, an officer found him curled in a fetal position on the floor. On another, he was found sitting alone with a knife, the two words, "I want," carved into a wooden chair. Fear for his safety and his mental state had led a superior to remove the bolt from his rifle. Even then, he retained his secret classification privileges. Manning's demotion may have also been linked to the fact that he now made little effort to conceal his homosexuality, even attending demonstrations against California's anti-gay marriage Proposition 8 while stationed in upstate New York. He told a reporter that he had been kicked out of his home and lost a job because of his sexual orientation. He said that the military's don't ask, don't tell policy was forcing him to live a double life. His Facebook statuses referred to a Boston boyfriend, Tyler Watkins, whom he had met while on leave there prior to shipping out to Iraq. Bradley Manning is glad he is working and active again, yet heartbroken being so far away from hubby, read one status update. And another, Bradley Manning is in the barracks, alone. I miss you, Tyler. Manning would write later of his decision to transition to becoming a female named Brianna Manning. On one of his leaves, he spent days dressed as a female in public and had begun planning for electrolysis and other sex change procedures after his discharge. But the moment that Manning would cite as setting him on the path to become his era's most prolific leaker didn't come during his social struggle in the Army's ranks. It occurred during his work as an analyst, one of the hundreds of thousands with access to the Army's endless classified troves of information. And it happened far more quickly than Ellsberg's long-burning transformation from hawk to dove. 15 detainees had been taken in by the Iraqi Federal Police for printing anti-Iraqi literature, and Manning was assigned to investigate the situation. He soon determined that the prisoners hadn't advocated violence, but had simply written what Manning described as a scholarly critique of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, looking into possible corruption in the Prime Minister's cabinet. I immediately took that information and ran to the officer to explain what was going on, Manning would later write. He didn't want to hear any of it. He told me to shut up and explain how we could assist the police in finding more detainees. I had always questioned the way things worked and investigated to find the truth. But that was a point where I was a part of something. I was actively involved in something that I was completely against, he wrote. Everything started slipping after that. I saw things differently. Manning dug deeper, browsing the State Department database he would later be accused of spilling to WikiLeaks. 251,000 memoranda describing the intimate dealings of the world's leaders in candid terms. He described crazy, almost criminal political backdealings, the non-PR versions of world events and crises, all kinds of stuff like everything from the build-up to the Iraq War during Powell to what the actual content of aid packages is. There's so much, it affects everybody on Earth. Everywhere there's a U.S. post, there's a diplomatic scandal that will be revealed. Iceland, the Vatican, Spain, Brazil, Madagascar. If it's a country, and it's recognized by the U.S. as a country, it's got dirt on it, Manning wrote. It's open diplomacy, worldwide anarchy in CSV format. It's beautiful and horrifying. Finally, he writes of a video shot from the cockpit of an Apache helicopter, showing a group of men being killed by the aircraft's heavy weaponry. At first glance, it was just a bunch of guys getting shot up by a helicopter. No big deal. About 24 more where that came from, wrote Manning. but the video was being stored in the file of the Judge Advocate General, implying that it was being used in some sort of military justice proceeding. So Manning tracked down the video's date, a day in July 2007, and its coordinates, a Baghdad suburb called New Baghdad. And he linked those facts with a story in the New York Times that revealed two Reuters journalists had been killed in the helicopter airstrike, along with nine insurgents on the ground and in a black van who the military said had been firing on U.S. soldiers. Manning knew that the men on the ground hadn't, in fact, been firing on anyone. The Apache helicopter had mowed down the group from above without any evidence that they were insurgents. And the black van that had pulled up beside the wounded and dying men to help them had similarly been mere civilians, a family hoping to save the lives of a group of strangers who lay dying on the street and sidewalk. But the helicopter had rained down bullets on the van, too, wounding two children and killing their parents. "Well, it's their fault for bringing their kids into a battle," one soldier quipped in the clip's audio track. "I kept that in my mind for weeks, probably a month and a half," says Manning. Then he decided he would hand it over to WikiLeaks, where it would become the prologue for a classified exposé to dwarf all others in history.